Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, the reviewer, and this podcast is the show where I review every single science fiction novel that I read, except this week, or this episode, where it's a little bit different. Instead, I'm going to be reviewing in one the fantasy books that I've read this year. More on that a bit later. First of all, some bits and pieces of news. One thing, this is what I wanted to say, is that if this is the first time that you've listened to this podcast, this is the first ever episode, this is not a good indication of what the book review podcast is normally about. It's normally a single science fiction book that I've read that I do the review of, and this time, like I say, I'm going to be doing not science fiction, but fantasy novels that I've read this year, and not a single book, but all of them put together. So it's going to be an interesting experience. I hope it works out. Some news is that, well, I put out the podcast last week, or whenever it was, 10 days ago or whatever it was, about Neal Stephenson's Anathem, and it was quite an epic podcast because it went well over an hour, but I did get a lot of good reaction for it. Not just good reaction, but loads more downloads. Normally in about in sort of like the week period after I release a podcast, normally gets around about 1,000 listeners, whereas this got over 2,000 listeners in 5 days, and I haven't actually checked since then, so it's got lots more listeners than normal. But so thanks for the emails and feedback from that podcast. It looks like a lot of people enjoyed it, or at least wanted to listen to it. I'm not sure if they enjoyed it or not. Other news is, well, I've been a bit ill recently. 2 days ago, I got to the, because I work on a cruise ship, and often on cruise ships you have these stomach bugs that go around. So I had a norovirus, a gastrointestinal bug, something like that. So I spent Boxing Day, the day after Christmas, spurting out of both ends, which was quite unfortunate. But it reminds me of last Christmas, actually, because last Christmas I was again away on a cruise ship and I got a trapped nerve in my spine, and that led to a lot of pain, but a lot more reading than I'd normally do, and some quite interesting podcasts at the same time. So anyway, there's a bit of news. Let's get on to today's episode. I don't read a whole lot of fantasy, or put it this way, compared to the science fiction, I think this year, what are we up to, episode 76, so I've read probably around about 30, 35, probably not quite 40 science fiction novels this year, and I've read I'm in the process of reading fantasy novel number 6. So I thought what I'd do, because lots of people are asking me, hey, why don't you just do a podcast? Why don't you just review all of the books that you read, not just science fiction, but fantasy as well? And I'm thinking maybe in the future I'm going to do that. But I thought what I'll do is just wrap up all of the fantasy novels that I've read this year, give my opinions on them, what I liked about them, and rate them as well. Might as well go for that kind of thing. And then I'm thinking in the new year, what I'll do is that I will, I won't change the name of the podcast, but when it comes to a fantasy book or novel that I read, when I review that, I'll just change the name for that episode to the Speculative Fiction Book Review Podcast. It's still the SFBRP, but just for a few episodes throughout the year, I'll just review the fantasy books as normal. So as a ramp up into that, so people understand what I like about fantasy, I'll just review these novels together. So the 6 novels that I'm going to review this time, let me just bring out, I put them in a spreadsheet so I can address them all at the same time here. The first novel that I read was The Wizard of Earthsea by Ursula K. Le Guin. I read that back, I think it must have been in January or something like that. The reason I read that book was because it was mentioned on the Geek Nights podcast, which I do enjoy listening to. They have a book club, and they recommended this novel, and I'd actually read it for years and years ago, maybe 15 years ago, but I've not read it since then, so I thought, hey, I will check it out. So it's a young adult book, like a kid's book. I'm not quite sure where it would be pitched, but you know, it's quite light reading, so I gave it a read. The next novel that I read was, again, it was down to a podcast that I listened to. It's a writing podcast called Writing Excuses. And there's 3 guys in there. There's Dan, who's an author who writes children's books, or like young adult books. There's a comic book artist and writer called, I can't remember his name now, but the main writer, the best known writer, I guess, of the 3 of them is Brandon Sanderson. And because, you know, I'm listening to his advice in the podcast, and all three of them, you know, talk a good talk, and they do quite well. And I respect what they said, but I thought, well, I can't really respect their advice until I read one of their novels and see how they apply this advice to their own novels. Because I find that in a lots of different ways, when you're sort of getting into a subject, you've got to sort of know the background of the person. And these guys are all published authors, so they must be pretty good. Unlike a lot of the advice out there in writing, where you know, it's maybe from a published author, but you've never really heard of them before or something like that. But this time, I thought, well, I'll give it a read. And he had a novel that he was releasing for free, Creative Commons, or it was like the third. He'd released it sort of chapter by chapter, but also he'd released the full text of like the first draft that he'd made of the novel, and then the second draft he'd made of his novel, and then the third draft he'd made of his novel. And I remember talking about it on an episode back when I read this. It was back in the spring sometime. So I read his novel there, and the next podcast, the fantasy novel that I read, was The Steel Remains by Richard Morgan, and I read it mainly because, you know, I was interested in reading his work because he's more of a science fiction author and quite an interesting science fiction author. And he said, hey, I'm going to put a new spin on fantasy. It's going to be gritty, it's going to be grown up, it's going to be adult, it's going to be all these different kind of things that he likes about his science fiction put into a fantasy novel. I thought, well, that sounds interesting, so I read that. And also I discussed it at length in the SFF audio podcast roundtable discussion that we had about that. So I'm probably not going to touch on this novel quite so much, because if you want to listen to my review of that, I did include that podcast in the feed here on SFBRP, so you'll be able to find it quite easily on iTunes. The next novel that I read was back in October. This next fantasy novel is, and it's by an author called John Lenihan. And it's called Shadow Magic, and it was released just a few years ago. That's the thing, yeah. Widowversity was released years ago, 60s, I think. Warbreaker, Steel Remains, and Shadow Magic, all from the last few years as well. Anyway, Shadow Magic, written by John Lenihan. Now, John Lenihan is a professional magician, and I am a professional juggler, and we both happened to work on the same cruise ship. And we were chatting, you know, we'd sort of met each other one day, but we were having dinner together, and he was saying that he's dyslexic, but he's also a novelist, and I thought that was quite interesting. So he talked a bit about his book, and I talked a bit about my writing and stuff like that. And he's trying to finish up, I think, the third novel in his Shadow Magic series. And at the time, I was it must have been November, actually, beginning of November, and I was just starting off with my NaNoWriMo attempt and stuff like that. So we were talking about the writing and stuff like that. But he gave me a copy of his book, and I said, well, you're leaving the ship in like 5 days, so I'll just read it and give it back to you then, so you know you can keep this copy yourself, because I'm not going to keep a copy of a paperback book while I'm on the road traveling and stuff like that. So it was actually really good fun to read a novel and be able to chat to the author of the novel as I was reading it about the different issues and the different things that came up in the novel and things. So that was actually really good fun to meet someone who's a fellow entertainer and cruise ship entertainer, as I am myself. And again, he has a lot of time on his hands like I do, so he turns his hand to writing and stuff. Again, it's another young adult novel. The next novel that I wrote was actually not long after that, was The Warrior Prophet, which is the second novel by R. Scott Baker in the Prince of Nothing series. And again, I read this novel because it's a follow-up to a novel I really enjoyed reading last year, recommended again by the Geek Nights Book Club, the Geek Nights Podcast Book Club, and I really enjoyed the first book. And then the last novel, which I'm going to be reviewing here, is called Elantris, and it's another novel by Brandon Sanderson, because I really enjoyed Warbreaker, and when I was in the airport in Miami, I was looking through the books, and I thought, well, what books are here? And I picked up Anathem, and I thought, well, I'll take that one to read. And I thought, well, that's not going to last me all this next 4 week cruise, so I better pick up another paperback book as well. But I couldn't find anything that really interested me, except I thought Elantris. And I thought, well, the whole point of these authors giving away their works as Creative Commons is that you'll read that book, really enjoy it, and then when you see their name or their book on the shelf, you'll pick it up and buy it. And it worked for me, so I bought Brandon Sanderson's, it's his first novel, it's another standalone novel, that's the good thing with these. All of these novels except The Warrior Prophet are either first novels in a series like The Wizard of Earthsea, or standalone novels like the rest of them so far. Oh no, except the Warrior Prophet. That's the second in this series. But Elantris, it was Brandon Sanderson's first published novel, and I've heard him talk about it quite a bit on his podcast as well. So I thought, well, that'd be interesting too to be able to sort of learn, like listen to the things that he's saying on the podcast about writing, and then have yet another point of reference to know. The thing is, I'm about 320 pages into it, and I'm pretty much giving up because it's. I'm almost exactly halfway through. Let me just see how many pages this has. Yeah, it goes on to like about 640 pages. So I'm exactly halfway through it, and it's just not interesting me at all. So I'm probably just going to put it down. I even looked up. I thought, well, what I'll do, so I can actually talk about it and maybe mention a bit more of the plot. I'll look it up on Wikipedia, spoil it for myself, like I've done, tried to do a few times now with these novels. But they haven't written the plot out in full and written all the spoilers, so I don't know what's going to happen at the end, but I just don't think I can bother to read. Like, because 320 pages is a good length for a novel, and yet I've got twice as long as this to go just to get to the end, and nothing's happened yet. So it's getting me down a little bit. So there's an introduction of the books and why I read them. So let's get into them a little bit more. In depth, I'll go through the points that I normally do, a little bit modified because it's. But I'll go through each of these novels in a little bit quicker now. So the world of the Wizard of Earthsea, it's like the time of legend. It's written as though all of these events happened way, way in the past. There's still monsters in the world, dragons are still there, but you get the feeling that when the book was written, or like the style of the writing when the book was written, it's telling of the time. You know, it's being written in a time when there's no more dragons, telling the legends of a long time ago. And Earthsea is like a sea that covers the whole earth, but there's lots of the scatterings of these little islands, like maybe like an archipelago, like in ancient Greece. It's that kind of setup there. And you get the feeling that that the people going from place to place, it's a bit sort of like Odyssey, Iliad style, you know, and they go from this island to this island, and they meet these people here, and then they go to that island. It's that kind of setup. Warbreaker by Brandon Sanderson. Now, what you get is this city of power, and it's this trading city, and gods reign in person inside this city. The gods actually walking around, and they talk to each other, and they talk to the people and things, and there's lots of politics and internal strife and things like that within this city, because the gods are reigning, but the priests have more power, and you know, there's a big setup there. Again, I'm not going to get into too much detail, but there's no single quest like in the Wizard of Earthsea. It's like a quest novel, whereas in the world of Warbreaker, everything takes place inside this single city, which is actually quite an interesting setup. The Steel Remains is set around about 10 years after this huge sort of like alien invasion or this monster invasion. And what happens is all these different kingdoms, these three separate kingdoms, they all sort of join together and they fight this invading force of these lizard monsters. This is sort of like the backstory being set up here. But then what happens after they're victorious over the lizards, then they all fight among themselves to keep control and to conquer each other and to try and, you know, once everyone's mobilized for war, they all sort of turn to infighting. One of the factions in this thing is like the elves, which aren't really the elves. They're called the Kyrieth or something like that. And they leave the world and just leave it behind. And the world is still recovering 10 years later from this invasion and from all this infighting. And so you get these cities that are set up and everyone's still going, oh, I'm not really sure. And slavery has come around about for the first time because, you know, after all these fighting going on and lots of different things like that. So the world's in turmoil and yet recovering at the same time. And nobody really wants to get into another one of these wars. So that's the world there. Shadow Magic is set in the current day, in the year 2008, let's say, or something like that. But it's not really set in our world, but there's this alternative magic realm, which is set parallel to our own. So it's a bit like Narnia, and the story is that a young kid goes through into the land of pixies and leprechauns and wizards and knights and all that kind of stuff. So it's a real play on the tropes and the ideas of fantasy, unashamedly so. So it's like, okay, we go here and we do this, and this is magic, I'm not really going to explain how they get from one world to the other. it doesn't really matter at all like that. It's just going to be a young kid goes on an adventure, because it's a young adult novel and it doesn't get bogged down in the history and doesn't get bogged down in that kind of stuff. So it's very light and it's more adventure based rather than world building based, even though the world is quite fun. I'm not going to go into the magic. I'll do that later here. The Warrior Prophet by R. Scott Bakker is very much a sort of medieval Byzantine kind of setup there. It's set on a continent called Irwa, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce it, like most of the names that I'm going to say here in this podcast. I don't know how to pronounce them. And it's like I say, this continent, and it's sort of like set up, it's called the Three Seas, in the area it's called the Three Seas. It's like the Mediterranean and the Black Sea and the Adriatic and that kind of area put together. So there's, you know, it's connected by sea, but also you can go around them. And it's telling the story, like the first episode of the first novel in this series was telling of this huge army that's coming together to go on a crusade. So it's very much like a retelling, like a fantasy retelling of the first crusade, and they're all coming together into Constantinople, but it's not really Constantinople, it's another city because it's a fantasy version of this, but they're all getting together and they set off on this war down on this holy crusade to liberate a city from the evil Muslims, sorry, not Muslims, the evil Fanim or whatever they're called. And this book is very much a continuation of that. So after getting the army together, they're setting off. But there's a huge history here, going back thousands of years to sort of like the ancient times. And you read about the battle that took place between the consort, which is this faction of non-men. In fact, I don't even want to go into it too much because there's a lot of complex history there. But through the dreams of one of the main characters, you're often reliving the battles and the conflict that happened thousands of years before, which everyone else thinks is just pure legend. But the people who relive these dreams over and over again, this wizard set up there. They all relive these dreams over and over again, and you learn the ancient history through there. And actually, I was saying in the last podcast that with Anathem, I was saying that sort of has world building that which is can rival, say, Dune and The Lord of the Rings. But I do think this novel or this series of novels too is sort of getting there. Sure, it's not doing it in it didn't really hit for me in the first book, but as we're going through the second book, the world is becoming bigger and they're learning more about the magic and they're learning more about the history. And like Anathem, which is like a retelling of the philosophical kind of history of Earth, but told from a different point of view with different characters, but still coming across the same mathematical proofs and truths of philosophy and things like that. You're getting the similar kind of thing with the Prince of Nothing series, but not quite as starting from foreign or from such unique points of view as, say, Dune or The Lord of the Rings, but it certainly is a wide, deep world that you can get into in the same way. And finally, Elantris, a bit like Wallbreaker, is a city of power and it's a trading city, and the gods reign in this city in person. And you know, there's lots of politics and things like that. But actually, what happened? Whereas Wallbreaker is the city of the gods, this is the city of the gods which fell. And about 10 years before the novel begins, the city falls. And so what happens is that you get these people living outside the city walls with this sort of muddy, fallen, crumbling city of magic with nobody living inside of it except people who get this certain disease. And that disease used to be the people who would turn into gods would get that disease and they'd go in there and everything would be fine for them. But now they get that disease and they become lepers and they're cast out of the world, outside the walls, sent into the walls, and they've got to get by there. And again, like I say, I haven't actually finished reading this novel and probably won't. So again, a lot of the history hasn't been fleshed out, but it wasn't interesting enough to keep me in the world. Moving on to the plots of the book, Wizards of Earthsea is a little bit, I guess you could reference now Harry Potter, but it was told, of course, long before Harry Potter. You get the young wizard of Ged? I can't remember his name. Wizard? Ged? Can't remember. Anyway, he's like a young, talented guy who has this talent for magic, and he's, I think what happens is that his father doesn't want him. I can't remember exactly what happens, but his auntie, I think, is a witch, and she teaches him a bit of magic, and then from there he gets more and more magic. He goes to wizard school and he learns all about the magic and how to control the wind and stuff. And of course, when you live in an archipelago and everyone goes around by ships, being able to control the wind and help navigation of ships and things like that and deflect storms away from ports is very important. And he releases, because he gets a bit big-headed, he releases an evil force in the world, and then the rest of the book is pretty much him going on a quest to try and control this evil force that he unleashed on the world, which I'm not going to talk about or spoil, but it's a fun plot. It's quite basic. There's not a whole lot into it. It's sort of like a short story. It's a very short novel, so it's like a short story worth of plot there, but it's quite satisfying. Warbreaker, what you get is a young princess who's sent to be the wife of one of the gods, one of the sort of reigning king gods, god kings in the city. Meanwhile, her sister goes in to sort of try and save her and try and work out, because it was like the wrong sister was sent in, and so the other sister who was meant to be sent in to be the wife of the king, she goes in and try and works out why the other sister was sent in instead, and to try and save her and to try and get everything sorted out. Meanwhile, you get this awesome guy with a sword who's, well, he's got this guy with an awesome sword, let me put it that way, and his sword has got a personality of his own, and you're not quite sure what he's up to, but of course he plays into it, and he's sort of scheming in his own right and killing people in his own right. He's the anti-hero, if you will, at this going on at the same time. And also, you get one of the gods themselves who is having a bit of a crisis of faith, which is actually quite an interesting thing, where he's a god who doesn't believe in himself, and I really liked that character. And again, those are the characters, I guess, but I can't really go into the plot very much because it is quite complex. But yeah, a lot of politicking, not a lot of battles, not a lot of fighting. It's very much about sort of the internal politics and the different characters working out what's going on with the world and working out how the magic works and all that kind of stuff. But it's an interesting story, and it did keep me tied in. And again, I remember talking about it ages ago on the podcast when I was reading it. I thought I was getting to the end, and then I thought it was going to be the end of the book, and then it wasn't the end of the book. It was just a badly formatted ebook, and then I thought it was going to go into a second book, and then it was a bit weird, but actually all the way through it kept me reading through to the end, and it was very interesting. I really enjoyed it, the story, that is, the plot. The Steel Remains is what happens. It's a bit of a like noirish kind of plot, because you get Ringel, who's asked by his mother to find a relative who's been sold into slavery. Meanwhile, you've got this political intrigue going on, and you know, this action taking place, and there's this plot, you know, that the king, or like one of the main emperors, is trying to work out there and stuff. And because it's very noirish, it's impossible in one of these kind of like detective, like mystery kind of stories, it's impossible to have two unrelated plot elements that go together, that, you know, that one person is investigating, another person is investigating. They will be tied together, of course, at the end of the novel, and that is, of course, what happens here. Plus, you get lots of fighting with swords and knives, and it is actually quite, I mean, it's not a very satisfying plot, and you can see it's setting up almost for the next novel in the series, but for what you get, it is actually pretty good. It does tie up the loose ends that you want to tie up. Although it does spend a bit too much time away from the main plot with some of these secondary characters, and you sort of go, well, I just want to get back to the main plot and see what's happening there. But there are sort of plot twists that I really enjoyed. For example, Ringel, who is like the main hero or anti-hero kind of figure, he gets into this duel, and I was really interested to see him go to this duel, and then he just doesn't turn up, and he's like, oh man, I missed it. And I was like, oh man, he missed it. And it's quite an interesting, some quite interesting twists on the normal quest or the normal adventure that someone would normally go on in a fantasy novel. It twists it around quite a bit. The plot in Shadow Magic is quite good fun. It's just a bit of an adventure romp, you know. Like I say, this one boy discovers that he's a prince in an alternative magic world, and he goes on an adventure to find his mother and to get the magic that he needs to save the world from the evil baddies. And it's not very complex, but it's a lot of fun. Like I say, you find out, you know, he learns how to fight, he learns how to use the magic, and this happens and that happens. And it's just, you know, it just goes from one thing to the next. And I mentioned before on these podcasts about the planetary romance, and it does bring in that kind of quest, you know, because planetary romance is sort of like the tropes of fantasy and science fiction, but with one person cast adrift in a new land and he has to find his way through. And that's what you get here. And it's a lot of fun. Again, not very complex, but it is like a young adult novel meant for kids, I guess. So there you go. The Warrior Prophet. I mentioned a bit before about where the plot goes here with the army setting off to the Crusades and they cross the deserts and they have big battles and things like that. Meanwhile, the characters, the main characters, you get Kellis. He's wielding more and more power. Again, I don't want to go too much into the plot here because it is the second in the novel and stuff like that. You get Akamian, who is the magician, and he gets separated from the main army and he has to then fight his way back and make his way back. And you get this, like I say, it's this epic struggle of them going through the desert and going through the going through these different battles and the different characters. And Kellis not just getting more political power, but is setting up his own religion and trying to wield power in that way, which is it's quite an interesting plot. And again, after the first novel, I was thinking, well, you know, it is very much sort of like this middling novel in a series of three. And it lays out, you know, the pieces that we're going to need now for the end of, like, this epic struggle in the third novel. However, unlike a lot of second novels in series of three and trilogies, even though it's in sort of a holding pattern, it's a lot of traveling. You're on the road all the time, and the characters keep pushing forward and forward and forward and forward. So even though there's not a main resolution to the end of the story, it is very much a second novel, and the loose ends aren't tied up in the way that you'd expect from the third book, or the way that they were sort of brought together at the end of the first book. Although, even if I didn't read the third book, I think I'd still be very impressed with where I've come so far. And Elantris, bring you onto the novel, which I've not completed yet. You get this young princess who goes to marry a prince or a king in a different kingdom. And meanwhile, there's a priest who's having a crisis of faith, and there's, you know, some other guy who's like the prince who's not doing very much. And again, it seems a bit strange that it's like Warbreaker. You can see so many repeated elements and characters from Warbreaker, but they're just not very well developed here. It's like, you know, Brandon Sanderson has got these ideas that he wants to write about and these stories that he wants to tell, but he just isn't going about it very well in Elantris. The plot, I'll say, page 320, and there's just nothing happening. Because what happens, like, things happen immediately prior to the first pages of the book. For example, like, the princess decides that she's going to go off and marry the prince in a different world, and you're not quite sure why she's doing this, because if she is so perfect, and if she's so headstrong, and if she's so beautiful, and if she's so politically clever, she'd be able to gain power, you know, in her own kingdom. You think, well, if someone is that perfect, they're definitely going to be able to, like, gain power, and she's going to be queen of her own father's kingdom, no problem at all. And yet she comes over to this other kingdom, and she's made this decision to do this beforehand, but then when she gets there, things aren't quite how she thinks. So then she's just spending hundreds of pages just trying to work out what's going on, and she's trying to do this political maneuvering and stuff, but it's just not interesting. It's like really, and you're not quite sure why she's doing it. It's like, oh, this guy's obviously a bad guy, I've got to go up against him. You're like, you don't even know what he wants to do. And it's the same thing with the prince character, the second most important viewpoint character. He gets this leprosy kind of plague and gets sent into the deserted city of the gods that's called Elantris. And, you know, he just sets up there, but and all he does is like, okay, well, I'm a prince, so I've got to be princely and people are going to follow me. And it just goes around. He sets up his own little kingdom inside Elantris, but it's not very interesting. It could have been interesting if I was just learning his story, but it's like piecemeal. This, he does this and that happens, and he does this and this happens, and then he has a bit of a trouble here, and then that happens. He has a bit of here, this happens, but nothing ever really gets in his way. Everything that he comes up against, he can just get past the same as the way that the princess does as well. And then again, it's the same thing with the main antagonist in the story as well, the priest, who's having like this crisis of the faith, and I guess that's going to be his main conflict, but he's going up against people, but then he's finding everything too easy as well. So what you have is 320 pages into the novel, you've got three people's storylines, and they're all going along, and I guess they're at odds with each other, but none of them have come into conflict with each other, even 320 pages in, or come into sort of any kind of conflict with each other that they can't overcome. So it's really weird that you've got three people working at odds to each other in a way, but there's no interest there. There's no conflict there, and it's really strange that someone can write that. Three different people, like I say, going up against each other, and yet I don't find any of them engaging, or I'm not interested in any of the conflict, which is really weird. So in other words, plot really bad. Moving on to the characters in these novels. How long have I been going with this podcast? It feels like I've been going quite a while. Oh, I can't find, where's Audacity gone? Oh, half an hour. Yeah, this is good. I should be finished up in maybe 15 minutes. Here we go. So, the characters. Yes, in The Wizard of Earthsea, the characters are a bit strange because they're told as legends. Like, we're being told the story of, say, it's like I've been reading Genesis quite a bit recently. If you want to read my almost a thesis on the patriarchs of Genesis, of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and other patriarchs there, you can read it on my blog. It's only about 8,000 words long, about a 20-page paper on my theories about the patriarchs of Genesis, which has been quite a lot of fun. It was my Christmas project to do over the week over Christmas after finishing the novel, after finishing the follow-up novel to Mining Tomorrow, and waiting for feedback from that. I'm keeping my hand in with that writing. Anyway, what you have here with The Wizard of Earthsea, it's sort of like stories being told in the same way that you'd read about, say, Abraham or Jacob or Isaac or Moses or something like that. So you don't really read about his, like, because it's like a very detached third-person omniscient narrator. So it's just telling his story. He did this and he did that and he did this and he did that. But also, it's being told in a way like, I'm talking a bit about the writing style here, but it's being told in the way like the Gospel of Luke, as it's sort of like, okay, you've heard this story before, but this is how it really happens, you know. So there's lots of talking about, well, you might have heard that he did this, but he actually did this. So it's like I say, it's detached at such a long view, written like 10,000 years later after so many legends spring up about it. So it's, you never really get into Ged's head or the other character's head. You do a little bit, but it's always sort of like the narrator is sort of winking at you knowingly. You know, you get this sort of like direct address from the narrator saying, well, you may think he's thinking this, but actually he was thinking that. So it's very strange, but the characters are quite interesting. You know, Ged, he goes on this journey, he's young and he learns and he grows up. And the other characters are very sort of archetypal, but it's written very specifically in that sort of archetypal style. It's not sort of lazy writing, is like crafting a legend, knowingly crafting a legend. Next up, we get Warbreaker. As I said before, you get this guy with a sword who's a badass, and the sword itself, because the sword is like this, it's embodied with the souls of these other people or something. I can't actually remember because it was months ago that I read it, but it's actually really creepy when you read about what the sword is like and the conversations between this guy with the sword, and the sword. I can't remember either of their names now. It's been months since I've read it, but it is actually quite creepy and very well written. And like the main god, who's like this over god, like the god of the gods. I can't really express how it is, but there's sort of like, I think there's like 12 main gods, and then there's one god who rules them all, and he's a very mysterious figure. And I don't want to give too much away, but he has an interesting story in his own right, and through the eyes of the young princess who gets sent to marry him, I actually feel, you know, you actually feel genuine pity for him, and it's really, really well written. And then you get this other god who's like the one who's having a crisis of faith. He is very funny, because he's just got a very funny voice. He's like I say, a god who's having a crisis of faith, who doesn't really believe in himself and doesn't take himself seriously, and has a very fun story as well, very well written, and like I say, quite fun to be with. And then the princesses themselves, who are the other two main characters, they're both suitably naive and young, and even the one who's the older princess, who's headstrong and is going out there on her own and she's going to do things by herself and things, she's also suitably naive and has to learn the ways of the world as well, which is very good. I'm very impressed with the characters in Warbreaker. And you get The Steel Remains by Richard Morgan, you get Ringel. Like, the three main characters are Ringel. He's very big and very gay. We talked about this on the podcast with the SFF audio, so go back and listen to that, of all of our opinions on big gay characters in big gay violent characters in fantasy. But he's very much the extreme anti-hero, and so much to the point where it's I can identify more with him more than other characters from Richard K. Morgan, even though he's gay and I'm not. But then there's sort of things that with him there, and insecurities which come out in the writing and his telling, and he's, you know, blustering and trying to cover stuff up so much. So it's actually a bit more depth to this antihero than, to say, in Black Man and in some of the other Richard K. Morgan novels. Then you get, I think her name was Arketh, and she's like this half elf, half human character, but not elf, but the other one, I can't remember what they're called either. And she has an interesting job in the novel, and her story is actually, I think, the more interesting story. Even though Ringle is definitely the main character, I actually liked her story a bit better, because she really goes out and does stuff and seems to have a grip on the situation, and I'd really actually like to read more of her story. And there's hints of a much deeper story with her in the novel, so hopefully in the next books in the series we get to read a lot more about her and her stories and the names of her knives, which again in the SFF audio podcast that we did about this, we all said that was a cool thing, cool little element in the novel, the names of the knives that she carries and throws around and kills people with. And then you get, I think his name was Edgar or Eager, and he's like the big guy out on the plains with the big weapon, and doesn't really do much in the novel, doesn't have a huge role in the novel except to sort of like fill out the world a bit and fill in a bit of the history and go on a little bit of a journey and then turn up and stab people at the end, or help stab people at the end. So his story wasn't that satisfying, but he was quite an interesting character, a little bit stereotypical, but well done in a way. Moving on to Shadow Magic. Lots of fun characters. It's first person narrative of a young guy, and it's a bit, you know, it's a bit sort of like young adult novel, typical, you know, young guy, not quite sure what he's doing in the world, has to find his feet, that kind of stuff. You can see the love interest coming a mile away, like all these novels, and the bad guys in this novel are really evil, suitably evil to be evil bad guys, and the minor characters, though, are actually really interesting. They've all got little quirks of their own, but not sort of quirks in the way, oh, that's his quirk and that'll be his character throughout it. They actually seem to, you know, they come into it and play a part in the plot. For example, I really enjoyed at one point the main character, I can't remember his name now, but like the young guy is learning, he's being taught how to battle and to fight with a staff. And he's been taught how to fight with a staff by his father back in the real world, but he never knew that his father was a prince in a fantasy world next door. And then he's being taught how to fight again in this fantasy world, and he's like, ah, this ancient or this old staff fighting instructor uses this move on him, and he's like, ah, well, that is of course the Bodkin's move that my father taught me how to deal with, and he manages to defeat it. And then he finds out that this old fighter is Bodkins himself. Again, I'm just making that name off the top of my head, but it's funny how he could bring in these little quirks and these little character moments in to fill out the world and to fill in the plot, and I really enjoyed it. All the characters in that novel, well, most of them, like I say, a bit shallow in some ways, but a lot of fun because it's a quick read and it's not, doesn't get bogged down with the characters or anything really. It just keeps moving at a very high high pace, fast pace there. You get in The Warrior Prophet, again, don't want to go into too much about the characters here because it's the second book in the series, but Kellis is turning out to be a Nazi dictator, which is quite an interesting journey to go on. And the women are suitably wretched and all whores or useless women just to be manipulated. And the main character as well, one of the other main characters, sorry, is Akamian, who's the main magician that we follow. And he seems to be getting a bit more of a backbone. And in the first novel, he was a bit sort of like, oh, I'm not sure what to do. Oh, I don't really know what's going on. Oh, what can I do? And then this time, he's really making decisions and he's going his own way and doing things in his own self. His suffering that he goes through, like I said before, he has to suffer through the nightmares of facing up against the consult thousands of years in the past is getting a little bit tiring, but he is getting over that as well. And his suffering, we're sort of made to suffer with him, which, like I say, can be a little bit tiring, but otherwise I'm enjoying the journeys that these characters are going on, except maybe the women, who are a little bit wet. But I guess that's the whole point of this book, is that they are a bit wet. But otherwise, characters coming on nicely in that series. And finally, Elantris. You get this princess who's too perfect, and you get this prince who's too perfect, and you get this priest who's too perfect, and the stupid king is way too stupid, and there's these children which keep popping up, and these children are perfect as well, and this young girl is really intelligent, but she's playing no part at all in the novel so far, but we keep being told how intelligent and clever she is, and how she can speak all these languages, and I'm like, oh, come on, if you're going to do this, you might as well include her in the story. And yet 320 pages after she's first introduced, or maybe 300 pages after she's first introduced, these kids are still not doing anything, and it's really annoying. And you get these blobs which hang out next. I didn't mention these before. If you're important, like you're a prince or a princess or something, you get these blobs that follow you around, and it's like, in a way, I know it's bad to say this, but it's like Brandon Sanderson has read sort of like the culture novels, and you get these sort of like headstrong female characters, and they're followed around by the male drone characters who sort of have funny quips to say and communicate at long range and all these different kind of stuff. And it's like these blobs that follow them around. I think they're called Scions or something like that, who communicate at long distance instantaneously with each other, you know, and these other things. And he seems to play the same role as sort of like as a sounding board for the princess as she says stuff. But it's a little bit stupid in a way. And it's a pity because, like I say, this novel could be good. Like, this whole setup of the City of the Gods, Fallen City of the Gods, could be interesting. But the characters are just so, like, stereotypical and shallow and annoying. It just doesn't interest me at all. Moving on to the battles and the action, and also I'll talk about the magic, because normally I talk about the science and technology, but here might as well talk about the magic, because I guess and the creatures as well. In The Wizard of Earthsea, you get, like I say, it's very detached. Like, he did this and he did that, so everything's explained as though we already know the stories, and the stories are just being cleared up. So it's like, and you may think that this guy was the first person to go here, and we're meant to just know what the island is. But actually, it was this person. He went there. And I was like, oh, okay. But we're not told what the island is. We're just told a bit about it. But everything's sort of filled in sweeping details rather than close details, in this sort of detached, like, this, he did this, then he did that, and then he did this kind of portrayal of a legend. But the magic system is interesting. You've still got dragons, but like you say, in this time, but you think, yeah, of course, they're going to be wiped out by the time this book is written. And then the power of the magic comes from knowing the name of the subject. So, for example, by knowing the name of a certain wind, say the Gulf Stream, well, that's the only wind I can come up with off the top of my head, by knowing the name of it, you can control it and things like that. And I mentioned how important that was. But it's not just that. If you know the name of a person, the true name of a person, you have power over them. So everyone carries with them 5 or 6 different names that they're known by, and it's only if you know their true name, which is the one that you control by that. So of course that plays a lot into the themes of the novel and that kind of stuff. Coming on to Warbreaker, there's not actually a lot of battles and action, but what is there is actually well portrayed. It's mostly the guy with the sword and these other people, these other sort of small factions that I don't want to spoil. There's a little bit of that, but there's, again, it's more into like the politicking and the maneuvering by the priests and the gods and the kings and the princesses, which is where it comes down and where the tension is, the dramatic tension is. It's not who can kill who, it's who can outmaneuver who. The magic is, there doesn't seem to be any like monsters or anything like that, but the gods take their power from the breath of humans, and every human has one breath, but they can give it up, or somebody can steal it from them, or they can sell it for money, or they can sell it for something else, or they can sell it for somebody else's soul. So you can sort of exchange them, and when you sell your soul, you become like colorless and lifeless, and that's actually what happens, is that the gods take their power by every week or every day, I can't remember how often it is, they take in the power from one of their subjects, and someone gives up their soul and becomes lifeless. Well, not so much lifeless, but sort of like soulless and colourless, and that's how the gods keep their power. But also, spells rely on colourful objects as well, so if there's no colour, they it's like they draw their power from something colourful. So if you carry around with you a red handkerchief, you can use the colour in that, drain it and channel it into some magic. And also you can use the souls that are in inanimate objects. And also, by putting the souls into inanimate objects, you can animate them and stuff. And I can't remember all of the details, but I remember that the magic system and the way the magic was portrayed made a lot of sense and was actually quite interesting there. So that's Warbreaker. Still remains. There is monsters. Actually, there's this great thing. Again, we talked about this in the SFF audio podcast, how you have these zombie worms and these worms which crawl into the corpse of a human and then animate it and sort of take over it, and which I thought was quite interesting in the opening section of the novels, but it never really came back even until the end of the novel, which was a bit disappointing because you can really see that Richard Morgan has these good ideas for, like, monsters and ways to sort of manipulate human flesh. Like, he grafts the heads of people onto trees, so the heads are there continuously living, but can't move and can't talk because they can't breathe, but they're living by planting roots into like a flower pot, and then people can take someone's head round with them in a flower pot, and it's actually quite horrific. And there's other things that are happening there in the same kind of monster way, with being sort of tying in monsters into human flesh, and there's the talk of the lizards as well that came in. You think they're sort of kind of aliens from a different planet and things like that, so that's quite interesting. But the actual magic that's being used, there doesn't seem to be any strict rules or limits on the power, and there's these journeys through the underworld and unknown passageways and things like that, which is a bit disappointing because I really wanted to get to sort of see where the limit of that is, because that's one of the most interesting thing with any technology and any magic system in fantasy, is the limits of it and how far the magic can go. And we didn't really quite get to the end of that in The Steel Remains. Hopefully in the next books, if I get around to reading them, if Richard K. Morgan gets around to finishing writing them, hopefully we'll see a bit more of that there. But of course the battles and the action, of course, because it's Richard Morgan, there's lots of well-written, very violent stuff. The end battle is quite interesting, even though you sort of know that the three main characters are probably going to survive, because you know that they're the three main characters, so you think, well, these guys are going to survive and maybe the other characters won't. So even though it was a very interesting battle at the end, I wasn't quite sure, because I knew it was the first in the series, you're thinking, well, these three main characters have to survive. Whereas, say, in Warbreaker and in Shadow Magic and in these other novels, you're never quite sure who will survive there at all. In Shadow Magic, though, you have lots of different battles, from the big battles at the end to lots of magic battles, like involving magic bombs and things like that. And there's also, you know, like the staff fighting and lots of horseback battles and things like that, which is actually quite good fun. And again, because it's a young novel, a young adult novel, there's never too much peril, you know, there's never too much at stake. I mean, of course, the end of the world is at stake, the end of this fantasy world is at stake, but, you know, it's never too much, you know, you're never too worried about the main characters. Although, not everyone does survive until the end, and the person who does die, it does sort of hit you hard. The magic system in here is quite interesting. The main magic, not the shadow magic of the name of the title, but the main magic comes from gold, or it costs gold, so you have to spend gold to cast a spell. So whoever owns the gold mines has the most power. Yet the shadow magic is this kind of forbidden magic, which uses trees or the sap from trees, but because trees are sentient, or most trees are sentient, they don't let anyone use it. So you get this shadow magic versus the gold magic, and it's simple ideas, sort of simple spells, sort of standard spells, which I actually quite enjoyed. And also, I didn't have to worry too much about how you get from the real world, our human Earth world, into this into the land, I think it's called, which is, it's all based on ancient Irish myths and legends and things like that is the main route there. So when I said leprechauns, I wasn't kidding about leprechauns. They are actually there, and all these other little creatures that run around and things like that. Also, I like the twist that the people from this fantasy land who come across into the real world, if they touch the ground, they die. They just shrivel up and fade into dust. So if they fall off their horses, that's what happens. They all sort of go puff into smoke, into a cloud of smoke. So that's actually quite good fun. In The Warrior Prophet, the second book in the Prince of Nothing series, you do actually have war this time, because in the first book there was these sort of skirmishes and there were wars told about. It's like this army would go there, but you never really read too much about the war except for this opening battles and some of these opening fight scenes. Whereas here, it pretty much starts with the first encounter on the journey between the main armies of the Christian crusade that's going across and the Muslim jihad, which is coming up against them. Of course, not using those terms and those religions, but that's what we have here as well. Now, what's written, the interesting way that it's written is that in the first book, everything was written from a very limited point of view, literally inside the heads of the people, except for the very last scene of the entire first novel, where it tells about how the army is packs up its stuff and heads off on the first steps of their crusade as a united force. Now, what happens here again is that you get that again, like when you're following the individual characters, you're right close to them in their heads, even though it's third person, of course, but you're very close to them, you're seeing the world from their point of view, until you get to these epic battles, and then suddenly the camera like swoops out, sort of zooms out, and you see the whole battlefield, and it's told in a very sort of like in the same way that the Wizard of Earthsea is like this very detached third person omniscient kind of view. It's like over here this battle, this army went up against this army, and this lord fell, and this duke killed this knight, and this prince killed this emperor. You know, it's that kind of setup. So you don't read about the individual fighting. It's not like, and this person stabbed this person with this sword and this, but you do get it at some points through. But it's very much like this, okay, this empire was at war against this empire, and this country was involved in this war and this thing like this. So it's really, it's like you're reading a history book of something that happened 100 years previously, and like a huge battle, which would normally take 2 days, is wrapped up in just the main encounters between the main points in the army and like the main tide. Sort of like at 12 o'clock they were here, but then by 1 o'clock they were here, and then at 2 o'clock they fought back to here. And it's literally within three sentences you can get that kind of huge scope of the battle, which I think really worked well. The magic and stuff in the novel is, or in this series, is really picking up, because it's not explained very much. It's sort of hinted at in the first novel how you get like this magic, but magic is banned by the Thousand Temples, which is the main sort of like religion in the Northern Kingdoms there, and they're not allowed magic, but you do get these different schools, and one of the schools is like the Scarlet Spires, and they, in the first book, they're told that they know magic, but it's not very powerful, it's not the most powerful. But then the Mandate School, which is the main magician character that we travel with, Akami, and he knows the Mandate power, and there was always talking that this is, I can't remember, he knows the abstract powers or something, or maybe it's the other way around, maybe one knows the abstract and he knows the sort of like the lower level magic. So he works at this very much a theoretical kind of thing. It's like, while the other people are working in the kind of realm of biology, he's working at the level of mathematics or physics. So when he goes, a triangle, they're going, like these, the other school is going, something like a leaf, which is in the shape of a triangle, you know. So they're working, when they do magic, everything is worked around sort of like creatures. They say, manifest a creature which goes and does this. Whereas in the Mandate School, they go, I will manifest a perfect square, you know, that kind of, or a perfect circle, a perfect sphere, you know, and it works much more on that kind of geometrical level. And well, that's it hinted at, and that's how I sort of worked it out, just by reading the hints in the first novel. That's really fleshed out and talks about a lot more in this second novel. So hopefully I haven't spoiled very much about it, but it's all there. And also you get glimpses throughout this novel about some monsters in the book which aren't explained, and everything that's normal magic, every time magic is used, other people can pick up on it and can ward against it with the I think it's called the Korai, which is something you hold against your skin and it stops magic from affecting you. But there's this other kind of magic which seems to be a way against that, which doesn't, you know, these Koroi doesn't have a way to fight against them and can't tell if it's existing or not. How long have we been going on here? For 52 minutes. I've really got to finish up here now. Okay, Elantris, magic system and all that kind of stuff. Halfway in, don't really know what's going on yet with the action and stuff. No action at all. Nothing's happened. There's been a few sort of skirmishes with battles, but I don't really care what's going on. And the magic system has got something to do with this door thing, and these magic blobs and stuff like that, and they write in the air, but yet 320 pages in, still yet to have any impact on the non-story Which is really disappointing so far. Getting on to, I guess, quickly go through the writing styles. I talked a bit about this with the Wizard of Earthsea, so I'll skip on to the Warbreaker. Now, Warbreaker, even though there's sort of like earth-shattering things going on, the writing style is quite light, quite flippant. Like I said, this god who's having a crisis of faith is like you say, he talks in a way which is very modern. All the language is quite modern here, even though it's set in like this medieval kind of Renaissance kind of setup in this city of the gods here. And because of that, everything feels a bit twee. Everything feels a bit light. And you don't think anything bad can happen, although it does then surprise you when something bad does happen. But you sort of get lulled into like a false sense of security with the very light language. But by the end of the book, it does sort of pick up a bit and move on a bit as well, which is good to actually see like a change of writing style and sort of writing ideas as a novel goes on, especially a longer novel like that, which is good. The Steel Remains is well written. You know, Richard K. Morgan, he can write a good fight scene, he can write a good character and things like that. It's pretty solid. And also he wanted it to be gritty. Like you said, he was very insistent that, you know, he wanted to write a novel which has got like the grittiness of the fiction that he likes to read and write, but you know, is a fantasy novel. And it does work out, but compared to something like The Warrior Prophet, where it really is gritty and things really, you know, is sort of like gritty on an epic scale, this novel it doesn't really hold up, though, even though he does what he wanted it to do. Whereas I think, like I said before, Warbreaker, because it's written in a light tone, when something bad happens, it's sort of surprising. Whereas when everything is written in a gritty way and anyone can die at any moment, and if the character thinks about killing someone, oh, he'll just kill someone like that, then when he does just kill something, it does lose a bit of its impact. So while it's very well written, I think if it had been toned down a little bit with the grittiness and with the bad language and the coarse imagery, it could have been a little bit more impactful, I guess. Moving on to Shadow Magic, it's a young voice, it's a first person, and it's actually quite funny because, when, as I said before, it was fun to read a novel and talk to the author about the novel as I was reading it and in multiple stages. So it was like these, you know, when you get read interviews with a novelist, it's funny that it's a way of like having an interview at the beginning of the novel when, you know, John Lenihan was telling me how he had written it and how he had submitted it and then how he had made an audiobook version of it for Podiobooks as well and things like that. So that was interesting. And then as I was reading it, I was saying, you got some confused cultural references. So for one point, he says he's from Scranton in Pennsylvania. I think that's where the young main character comes from. But then he was mentioning the SAS and that's very much a British kind of thing. And if he was really from Pennsylvania, he would have mentioned the Navy SEALs or some other kind of thing like that. And I actually mentioned this to John. He was like, "Ah, yeah, you just read until the end of the book and that'll be explained." And it was actually explained by the end of the book. So that's interesting. And again, it's a fast-paced narrative, young person, very suitable for young people. And another thing that he mentioned was that when he first made it as a Podiobook, it's one of the most downloaded Podiobooks or audiobooks on Podiobooks.com, and it's like the highest rated one on there. It's got like hundreds and hundreds of 5-star ratings, well above any other novel on there. So it's a very, very good book. And he was mentioning that he could track the downloads from the website. So what was happening is that people were downloading it through to about chapter 3 and then not listening to it anymore, and I was wondering why not. And then he said that he worked out what was on in chapter 3, and there was a swear word in it, and someone said the word bastard, or bastard, or whatever you want to pronounce it in whatever accent, bastard, and he realised that a lot of families were listening to this novel together. He got lots of people emailing him saying, "Oh yeah, I listened to this in a car journey with my entire family, and we really enjoyed it." And he worked out that these families were getting to the word bastard, and then switching it off, and not listening to the rest of it, and not downloading the rest of the podcast, which I thought was quite funny. So what he did, he went back, edited the file, uploaded it again without that word, and called someone a scallywag, or whatever it was, instead of bastard. And then from then on, he kept his listeners and he kept the same amount of downloads after chapter three. And I thought that was actually quite a good reflection of the level of writing on here, especially after a novel like The Steel Remains, where all the four-letter words are on pretty much every second page of the novel. Here, Shadow Magic, everything is kept light. And also on page 161, he uses the letter L instead of the character, the letter I for I, and I picked that up, and he was very impressed with me for picking up that. But then again, I do pick that thing up. And I also, it's available as an ebook, I think, as well, because as I was reading this, John was also reading the ebook version on his Sony Reader that is released too, so you can read it there too. Moving on to The Warrior Prophet, it's the writing style, as I said before, it's very limited, but it's I said a few more wide shots in this book as well. When I say limited, it's very like third person limited kind of thing there. But it's very, very well written. The prose is amazing. It's dense. It's full of details. The world building is phenomenal and everything like that. And again, it is hard work, and it's probably why this thing isn't available in an audiobook, because it would be quite a drag. It sort of, again, does bring back like the not quite the style, not quite the denseness of Anathem at times, but there's a lot in there, and it's a chunky read, but very good. And Elantris is just tedious, and it's just people sitting around or standing around explaining stuff to each other. This is the writing there. It's just not interesting at all. And also, it gets to the point where, like, and this always comes down to the thing. So if you've lived your whole life next to the City of the Gods, you'd know something about it. And then if it fell, you'd know more about it. But then you get thrown in there and suddenly you don't know anything about it. So you're always going, oh, I wonder what's going on here. It's like, you've lived, you're 30 years old and you've lived next to this city all your life. And it's been there all your life. You'd know more about it. If you're the son of the king and you're meant to be so intelligent, you'd have read a book in your life. But then they don't know what's going on. And then this princess who's like really intelligent and she knows what's going on and things like that. You know, everything. She's so political and she's got hand in the pulse, but then she just turns up, and again, there's all this really obvious stuff that you would know about if you're a princess of a kingdom and you decided to go and marry a prince of the neighboring kingdom. You'd just know stuff, and they just don't know it. And it's like, I would know this if I'd have lived in that country, or if I visited that country for a day. I'd know a bit more about the politics than you do. And it's just really sort of flaccid. Like I said before, they turn up and everything of importance has happened before the novel starts, and then nothing of importance happens in the first half of the novel. So it's just loads of people sitting around explaining stuff to each other and asking each other questions and trying to find stuff out which they should know already. And also, wait a second, I folded the page over at this point, because it always really annoys me at this in this thing. We got page 94. Someone says something, she's painting. She's meant to be really perfect at everything, except she can't paint. And it's like they've put this in, or Brandon Sanderson put this in, just so this perfect princess, this perfect bride, this perfect woman is imperfect in some way, so she can't paint. And I'm like, great, she can't paint. And then everyone takes the piss out of her painting in this really like pathetic way. It's like, oh yeah, she tried to make a flower and all she managed was this brown smudge which only vaguely resembles a horse. And it's like, Serene, I've never actually pronounced this word out right, but the name of the princess blushed as the table laughed, you know. And it's like, wait a second, that wasn't funny. And then time and time again you're like, oh, and they rolled around on the floor laughing. I'm like, it wasn't funny. You can't have people rolling around on the floor laughing if it's not funny. And that's the thing which really set Warbreaker apart from Elantris. It's like, when funny stuff happened, it was funny. But because this god who was having a crisis of faith had a very dry sense of humour, and every time he told a joke, he was like, oh man, I thought that would get more of a reaction. So he's always admitting that his joke might not be funny, but he's always making jokes anyway. And it works really well in that novel. And there is other comedy and there is other fun stuff going on in the novel too. But it is actually funny. And yet you don't have, oh, and he rolled around on the floor laughing. It's like, you don't show forced reactions to comedy if it's not actually funny. It's possible to do funny without having that. You know, I talked about that in the review of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Just have funny, but don't have out of character reaction to funny. Anyway, last thing here. Oh, this is going to be another long podcast. But hey, I am doing 6 full reviews in one podcast without a break. Hopefully this hasn't been too confusing. Moving on to the themes of them. Wizardversity, it's a lot about responsibility for taking actions in the past and growth and things like that. So it's really like a coming-of-age novel, interestingly enough. Warbreaker, it's got this whole theme about becoming a god and the responsibility of a god. Now, listening to the podcast, Writing Excuses podcast, which they've got like 3 years worth of podcasts there. They're only short, which is actually really good for listening to. They're only 15 minutes long. But you sort of get to know the writers here, and you get to know what they write about and why they write stuff, because that's what they're talking about. They talk about their motivations, and they talk about the themes that they enjoy writing about. Now, one of the things that Brandon Sanderson said that he really likes is the idea of the city of the gods, and that's what you get here in Elantris, and you get it also in Warbreaker too. And for me, my theory behind this is because he's a Mormon, and in the Mormon faith, the ultimate destination of all of the Mormon faithful, you go, like, after you die, you go into different, you know, if you're chosen, you go into this die. But what the ultimate destination of that is that you become a god of your own, and you have your own world for you to be a god over, which is very appealing for a religion. You know, it's like in Christianity, you die, you go to heaven, you be with God. Mormonism, you die, and in the end, you become a god yourself. And that's like, hey, that's really appealing. And I understand, and, well, this is my theory, that's why he enjoys writing about people becoming gods, because as a Mormon, that would appeal to him, and he's trying to get it out. So he's with this character who's like a god who has a, that's my phone going there, 1 second. That was housekeeping calling about cleaning my room after me getting the norovirus and stuff like that. Anyway, I think I was just talking about Brandon Sanderson talking about becoming a god, and it's an interesting way to talk about gods in the future. If you became one of those gods, what would your opinion of your world be if you're a god? Which, again, is to me, it's quite an interesting theme there, and there's other themes going in there, but that's the one that I picked out from both reading the books, these two books of his that I've read, or mostly read, of Elantris, and the podcast as well. The Still Remains has got some good themes in there. Again, picked up on them quite a bit in the SFF audio podcast, which you can listen to. Like I said, it's in the feed on the iTunes for this podcast as well, so go back and listen to that. But of course, the whole idea of having a homosexual as a lead character in a fantasy is dealt with quite interestingly, and also the violence in the world is too. But also, again, it comes up time and time again in Richard Morgan's novels of the role of women in the society, and especially using the abuse of women and the abuse of prostitutes and the abuse of women slaves as a way to justify the actions of violent anti-heroes. For example, if someone just commits murder anytime he wants to, it's really difficult to have someone who he can fight against, which you can then go, yeah, go on, kill him, yeah, go on, you kill him. And the one way that he does this over and over again in I think every novel that I've read so far is with the abuse of powerless women, and anyone who rapes a woman is like, okay, he's fair game, I'll kill him. Sword through the gut and things like that. So those are some themes there. Shadow Magic is some fun things. It's mostly about friends and family and sticking up for your friends and the family. Again, it's a young adult novel, so it's a good message to stick across there in there. And The Warrior Prophet, finally here, is it's very deep philosophy, lots of religion questions, history questions and stuff like that. But again, there's so much of it. It's really heady stuff there. And I mentioned before, in the same way that that Anathem goes over, like rehashes our world history in other terms, it's like that's what The Warrior Prophet is doing, but delving deeper into the philosophy, into certain areas of philosophy, in a way where you can really see that R. Scott Bakke himself is much more of a philosopher than, say, Neal Stephenson. Neal Stephenson has got a handle on philosophy, whereas R. Scott Bakke is bringing into philosophy things which I've not read at all before anywhere. And again, it's maybe just me not being well read in philosophy, but I think it could be that R. Scott Bakke is bringing in things that he can talk about more when you have someone who's manipulating people on the level that the main character Kellus is here, and also Knair, the main barbarian figure as well, in his way of fighting that and his outlook on life, knowing what he's going up against and how to fight against it and things like that. So that is actually quite interesting. And of course, you've got the whole establishment of a new religion in another religion, so that plays in there really well too. And also in Elantris, you've got, you know what, I don't care. It always comes down to this. In a novel, which I don't like so much and is just a real struggle to get through, it gets to the point where I just don't care what the author has to say about the themes that he's bringing up. It's just like, you know, you just think, well, it would make me think if I could concentrate on this, if it didn't send me to sleep within a page of reading it, I guess I would actually think more about the novel rather than just waiting to get to the end. So again, I can't really talk too much about the themes of this, except of course the themes that are well portrayed and well done in Warbreaker are sort of really clunkily done in Elantris. So, finally, the part you've all been waiting for, the rating of these novels. Again, oh wow, an hour and 10 minutes here. Let's just quickly clear this up here. The Wizard of Earthsea. I really enjoyed it. I read it before, but it is quite a light read. And again, it's not really that... you got some stuff to chew on, but it's not really that challenging, and I do like challenging ideas in novels. But again, it is written for a younger audience. So I'll give it 3 stars, maybe 3.5 stars. Again, it doesn't have to be that locked in, the rating for here. It doesn't really matter too much. But, you know, it's a good 3.5 star novel. Maybe if you're 12 years old and this is like the first fantasy book you've ever read, it'll be like a 5-star book and you're just gonna go, oh, I gotta read the rest in the series, yeah, straight away. I've never read the rest in the series. I think I've only ever read The Wizard of Earthsea, I think. Anyway, I'm not quite sure. Warbreaker, lots of fun. It's free. I think you can just download it as Creative Commons from lots of places too. If you can't find it anywhere, email me and I'll send you a copy, because I probably still have the ebook version on my laptop somewhere. It's really good fun. And yeah, about 3.5 stars, between maybe 3.5 stars, 4 stars. Yeah, probably not 4 stars, but because there are a few things about it which aren't good. But let me put it this way. It is better in every single way than Elantris. And I mean, that's not saying a lot because Elantris is so bad. So actually, let's bump it up a bit. Let's say about 4 stars for Warbreaker, because it has got some interesting things in there. Like I say, the magic system is interesting. The whole... God with the crisis of faith is well done, and the characters are all interesting enough, and also the twists and turns are well done too. For example, the way that all the magic system and the history all comes together and pays off in the end, it's sort of like, oh yeah, of course, sort of like that, as they even say on the Writing Excuses podcast, sort of like the unforeseen but inevitable twists that you see. It's sort of like surprising yet inevitable ending of the story. I think I can't remember the exact quote there. Still remains pretty good, strong effort, did what he said to do, so I'll give that about 3.5 stars. I don't think we actually... I think I gave it a rating on the SFF Audio podcast, but I think someone mentioned that I didn't, so it might have been edited out because it was that discussion that we had was edited down from a longer discussion into the one that we had there. So yeah, 3.5 stars there. Pretty good book. Shadow Magic. Again, it's probably because I was chatting to the author as I read the book. I probably got more out of it than most people would do, but it was good fun. It's, as I said, it's the top-rated audiobook on podiobooks.com, so you can get it for free there. I haven't listened to it, but apparently it's really good. Other people that I've... that when I mentioned this book before that was reading it, other people emailed me to say that they've read it and rated it really highly. I give it 4 stars. It's quick, it's short. And again, if I was maybe a 14-year-old kid, I would probably give it more than 4 stars because it would probably appeal to me in a lot more levels, or more at my level. And finally, The Warrior Prophet. Really, really great. Definitely one of the best novels I've read so far. And actually, I think a step up from the first novel in the series, which I said before, it's very, very strange that the second book in a trilogy can be better than the first book. But I think this is one of those times when the second installment in the trilogy is actually better. I'm going to give it 4.5 stars because it appeals to me in a way that I just want from fiction, especially fantasy, and even from science fiction in a way. Just the world is so rich, the writing is so so well done. The characters are very well realized and engaging, even if I don't like any of the characters. Or maybe there's one, two characters which I can actually identify with in any way at all, even slightly identify with them, and yet it really pulls me in, and I think that's just a testament to how good the book is. And of course, Elantris, haven't finished it, not going to rate it, but if I was going to rate it, if I did push through to the end of it, just how bad the first half, even if the second 320 pages of this novel are the best 320 pages of fiction I've ever read, even though I'm not going to read it, even if they were, I could still only give this book one star, because it's the first half has just been so much struggle to get through, you know, and I thought, well, I'll at least get halfway through the book. But it got to the point where I wanted to do this podcast before the end of the year, because it is like my fantasy reads podcast of 2009. So I wanted to put it out before the end of the year. And so I thought, well, I'll just do it before finishing this book, but I'm probably not going to finish Elantris. So if anyone can just send me a synopsis of what actually happens in the book. I was going to say what happens at the end of the book, but, you know, what actually happens in the book and what the whole point of the book was, that'd be really, really well received. Or just update the Wikipedia page and actually put all the spoilers and explain everything what happens there as well, because I really want to know what happens at the end of the book, but not enough to actually finish it myself. So, yeah, actually, that's been quite fun. Follow me on goodreads.com as I go through these novels. Goodreads.com/Luke Burridge. Follow my reviews or become my friend or whatever you need to do to get my reviews. I actually found out that I'm the most followed person on goodreads.com who lives in Germany. I have like 15 followers on goodreads.com, and apparently I'm the most followed person in the whole of Germany, which I find quite funny. But when I said Elantris, reading Elantris, someone said, oh, don't read that, it's crap, it's all cliched and everything like that. And someone else, and then I was like, oh, I'm struggling with Elantris. Someone says, not as good as Warbreaker. And I'm like, yeah, Warbreaker was better in every single way. And other people have been throwing their comments in there as well. And also the book that I'm reading at the moment, I say reading, through lots of people who actually say, no, just you say you don't do audiobooks, but just try out some audiobooks. And people said, just check out audiobooks. So I'm trying out The Rookie by Scott Sigler, and actually really enjoying it a lot more than I thought I would do. Mainly, I think it's because over the past few years, by working on cruise ships, so certainly this time of year, I've been watching more American football than I ever thought I would. And because I've been watching American football, this novel is actually makes more sense to me now, I guess. So I'm enjoying reading, and it's actually really well produced as well, even though the story is, I'm not quite sure what's going on the story, even though I'm like 10 episodes into it. It's pretty good at the moment, so I look forward to reviewing my first ever audiobook, my first ever full audiobook here for the SFBRP on the next episode. I might also do a look back at all of the novels I've done in 2009, reviewed in 2009 like I did, a look back at 2008, but I'll probably save that for by the time I get home back to Berlin in the first week of January. Otherwise, follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burridge on Twitter. Follow my blog, which I'm posting lots of stuff up there recently. Lots of bits about writing, about the writing process for my novels, other bits of writing that I'm doing, lots of photography. And there'll be more news coming up in the new year as I release my video project as well. So keep an eye out on that. And I think that's it. Otherwise, email me, luke@juggler.net. If you've enjoyed this review, this six-part fragmented review, which has gone on far too long again, I will try and do a much shorter review next time. I'll see if I can get it down to around between 30 and 40 minutes, I think, is my favorite length of review. Even though if it's a good book, I like going into more depth. And if it's a bad book, I like going into more depth too. but otherwise, yeah, I'll try and make it a bit shorter next time out. Otherwise, catch you next time.